so much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Welcome into Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton. Coming up today, we've got an extended conversation with Dr. Mike Studer. When it comes to just about anything that has just about anything to do with overall health and well-being, there's nothing he can't add some valuable insight to. If you have an interest in avoiding Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, or really any degenerative disease, if you have a fear of falling, if you're taking GLP-1s, if you don't understand the benefits of dual tasking, if you're curious about the prospect of neurogenesis, continuing to grow brain cells as we age, if you want to learn how to bank sleep or even fitness, stick around and fasten your seatbelt because it's going to be a wild and informative ride. This is Growing Bolder. Well, I really have no idea where today's conversation is going to go, but I'm all excited about that. Our guest is an author, college professor, neurophysical therapist. He's a researcher, a speaker, an entrepreneur, a geriatric rehabilitation expert, a falls prevention guru, a world-renowned expert on the brain, and he's a marathoner. And it's not the kind of marathon you might think. He's the world record holder for the fastest underwater treadmill marathon. He initially set the record back in 2012 and has broken it three times since. He is Dr. Mike Studer, and he's written a new book that's called The Brain That Chooses Itself. I actually met Dr. Studer when we both spoke at the International Council on Active Aging's National Conference. We were both in the opening general session with Dr. Richard Carmona, the former U.S. Surgeon General, and even though we didn't spend a whole lot of time together, it was quickly obvious that we are basically brothers from another mother when it comes to our shared interest in the pathways to happy, healthy, and active aging. So let's get with it. Let's see where this conversation takes us as we welcome Dr. Mike Studer. Mike, how you doing today?
I'm doing just great, Mark, and I am so pleased to be here with my brother from another mother.
I'm excited as well. Let's start with the title of your book, if we can, The Brain That Chooses Itself, a reference to the power and the importance of choice that we all have in our daily lives. Why did you choose that title?
Yeah, you know, there's so much, Mark, that's out in the literature and the space on lifespan and health span. And so many people are so much more intelligent than me. They're putting out in podcasts and books and in many different areas of media. However, what I think is a through line that appears to be missing is the ability to give the person that needs to change the opportunity to select what feels best to them. And we know from placebo effect and so many different studies on belief and self-efficacy that things that will be valuable are made more valuable when we choose them, we believe in them, and we have autonomy of that process.
I love that. I've never heard anybody put it quite like that. And as soon as I got into the book and realized that's where you were going, I was hooked. And we will dig into the details of those choices that we all have in just a moment. But in the introduction, and I love this, you say that nearly every variable that we can manipulate to improve our own health will benefit from belief. How are choice and belief connected? How do they together, Dr. Studer, drive results?
So if you look at the actual medical literature of a term called self-efficacy, I believe that I have some control over my outcome. And you were to look at coronary artery bypass grafts, so open heart surgery, or you were to look at total joint replacement, or you were to look at hundreds of other medical procedures, the scientific literature is irrefutable that when an individual has self-efficacy, has choice, they chose their surgeon, they believe they'll have a good outcome. I had a good outcome in my left total knee. I'm going to have a good outcome in my right total knee. That exponentially 10, 15, 17 to 25% in varied different populations, as well as across the continuum of different conditions, it's always more powerful to have belief and to have that growth mindset And it will improve the outcome of any surgeon, any hospital, if they just selected people that felt they were going to have a good outcome. So as a matter of fact, there are things that we can do as healthcare providers, as individuals for our own change agency, and anyone can do to ensure that our outcomes are maximized. So belief and choice always improve the efficiency and effectiveness of anything we do. You could go back to taking a snake oil. Placebo effect improves it, but actually using something that is helpful, surgical procedure, therapy, medication, and also inserting belief, now you're talking about power.
Your book is organized around five keys, five pillars, call them what you will, to extending our health span. And those five keys, Mike, are physical activity, nutrition, sleep, social connection, and novel experiences. Can we run down each of them, you know, very quickly? And I know we can double back and talk more about any of them, but if that's okay, you know, physical activity is the salve that soothes these days. I just don't know that enough in the medical profession talk about physical activity. How important is physical activity to maintaining a health span as we age?
So, Mark, if I were to just get the very cut to the quick ideas here, number one on physical activity, the first thing that I would say is let's make it approachable and easy, and let's make certain that we distinguish the fact that a lot of people think, well, physical activity, that means exercise. That means I've got to have a gym membership. I've got to have weights. I've got to have machines. I've got to get up early. I've got to get equipment. And that's exactly what makes it unapproachable. It puts friction between being physically active and actually accomplishing it. So physical activity can feel like purposeful volunteering, can feel like childcare and pushing a stroller, taking your dog for a walk. And physical activity right there. Point number one is it doesn't have to be exercise. Point number two, very quickly, is it can be brief and intense. Small exercise snacks or vigorous intermittent lifestyle physical activity. 30 seconds of moving fast. And the big take home there is that you can actually earn back 4 to 1 or 7 to 1. So 1 minute spent of being vigorous can earn you 4 minutes of lifespan back. And some studies are upwards of 7 minutes. So those are the two quick things that I would put into physical activity. The third thing I would say is being active in your 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s actually is an investment for your 70s and 80s. And studies are now showing you can delay or mitigate the onset of many of the degenerative diseases by investing in intensive exercise during those decades.
All right, I'm gonna insert something here before we move on to nutrition, because you said something that I'm passionate about. I think in your book you do call it investing in the future. I call it prehabilitation. And for my money, you know, there's so much we can talk about. What are the keys to active, healthy, joyful aging? And to me, if you wanna bring it down to two words, if you wanna bring it down to the simplest concept, it's prehabilitation. And rehabilitation. It's preparing for the inevitable setbacks that we will all face as biological beings. And then it's our ability to bounce back, to recover, to rehabilitate from those once we do encounter them. Do you agree with that simplistic formula for happy, healthy, active, joyful aging?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what, Mark, I learned from you when we were at the ICAA today together, and I'll tell you, I really like that happy, healthy, joyful aging about it, because that physical activity can feel just like something that you want to participate in that's just joyful. You know, pickleball, dance, whatever is physical activity. But let's come back to your comment about prehabilitation and rehabilitation. You might think, well, gosh, he's been a physical therapist. He's made a living on it. He's got to be biased toward healthcare. And I'll tell you, every step that we can make and take to having ourselves positioned so that we don't have to be healthcare consumers in a prehabilitative manner is powerful. I mean, one of the chapters in my book, I talk about practicing things with your non-dominant hand, keeping yourself nimble mentally with challenging yourself in novel concepts, So if something slides away in health, you are prehabilitating yourself, and you're mitigating any of the functional disability you might have if something that you cannot control does happen.
We are speaking with Dr. Mike Studer, a world-renowned expert on the brain, the author of The Brain That Heals Itself. And Mike, we'll get back to the five keys to active longevity, to extending health span in your book. But, you know, I mentioned that you are an expert on the brain. And there's a study that just came out that is really kind of stunning. Basically, the incidence of Alzheimer's over the age of 50 is up to 42%, twice what we thought it was previously. And I think the tragedy of that is we've all learned that there are ways that we can delay, slow, and even prevent the onset of cognitive decline and Alzheimer's and related dementias. What are we doing wrong? As a brain health expert, are you encouraged by the fact that we have more control than people realize, or are you discouraged when you see reports like the one that just came out?
You know, I'm discouraged by the numbers. I'm encouraged by the possibilities, especially going back to prehabilitation, preventative efforts, and wellness. Here's a couple of big reasons why I'm encouraged. Number one, our ability to screen for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's has never been better than it is right now. So part of the numerology, if you will, the statistics are that we're actually diagnosing it earlier, recognition's gone up, and that we have a number of individuals massively moving up into that over 50, over 60. And so we've got a big emphasis on it. We're recognizing it better. Here's the other reason why I'm encouraged. Our scientific applications for the prevention of conditions that you are even genetically predisposed for has never been better. So we've got wellness gyms throughout the nation, at least here in the United States so far, that are active brain gyms being built so that people get an opportunity to engage in cognitive and physical activities, dual tasking together. There's never been such a thing like that. There's exergaming that's possible. Our ability to understand that things that we were trying a decade ago are luminosities and crossword puzzles and et cetera. Those were great efforts at cognitive stimulation, but they missed the mark because they're not novel. They're not creating enough intense opportunities, and they're not engaging the brain to increase cerebral blood flow. So because of what we have not been doing and what we now are starting to do, that really pushes me toward the encouraged rather than discouraged.
You mentioned dual tasking, and I know you are, one of the, if not the major proponent of dual tasking. Explain that a bit more, Mike. What do you mean by dual tasking, and why is it important to our brain health?
So dual tasking is the act of participating in two separate activities that can be done separately and measured separately at the same time. So for example, in your daily life, you're dual tasking on a regular basis. When you are making an effort to listen to a podcast and brush your teeth and trying to actually retain some of that podcast information rather than just being a passive recipient, you're dual tasking. When you're making an effort to try to do some of your morning balance exercises and you're trying to stand on one leg and brush your teeth, that's dual tasking. But again, there's a lot of things that happen just in natural daily life that cause us to be walking and listening to a grandchild, walking and avoiding a dog that we're walking, etc. So dual tasking is I've got my mind one place and my body another place. And the reason why that's healthy is because we get the benefit of blood flow to the brain by being active, and we force the brain to keep the movement at an autopilot level. This is the most important thing we can consider about dual tasking. Because the attention center and the cognitive resources are constrained and they're occupied, our brain is left to process the act of walking, the act of balancing, or anything else you might be doing, dribbling a basketball, driving a car, or otherwise, keeping that at the automatic level. So those brain centers, basal ganglia, cerebellum, these are major brain centers that are important in Parkinson's disease, stroke, and otherwise, they stay healthy and they keep that action, the movement, very proficient, skilled, and automatized.
That's Dr. Mike Studer, a renowned brain expert, sharing the importance of belief in any and just about everything we do. In his words, every variable that we can manipulate to improve our health, whether it's diet, exercise, socialization, whatever it is, if we believe in it, the impact will be greater. What the mind believes, the body embraces. This is Growing Bolder. More with Dr. Studer when we return. Growing Bolder and Humana are celebrating the opportunity of aging and smashing stereotypes with the new 65 Plus. We're sharing examples of people 65 and older who are pursuing their passions and leading happy, healthy, and active lives. You can inspire others by sharing your own photos and stories. Find more information at growingbolder.com/new65plus. Welcome back to Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton. We're talking today with Dr. Mike Studer. And when we left the conversation, he was talking about the many brain health benefits of dual tasking. Your mind is focused on one thing while your body is doing something else. And that made me curious to get his thoughts on the difference between neuroplasticity and neurogenesis, two amazing abilities of the brain that we didn't even really know existed until relatively recently.
Okay, let's take neuroplasticity first. 83 billion neurons or so in the human brain by the time we're adults. Each one of those neurons can make anywhere from 5,000 to 100,000 connections each. So this is a multitude of different roadways and routes that our brain can interconnect. Neuroplasticity means we have the capacity throughout life to dynamically reorganize those connections in accordance with learning. Most of the time, that learning is consuming good things. Oh, that wonderful memory, or I've learned how to balance on my right foot, or I've learned how to start up or reboot my computer, or I've learned how to use a social media app. So any new learning, no exception, is always going to make new connections in the brain. And that is the definition of neuroplasticity. Fact-based learning, episodic memory or event memory, things that happened to me in my life, as well as motor skills, all of those are memories that we learn. All right, there's neuroplasticity, happens throughout life. All right, neurogenesis. Well, it was once thought that we could not create new neurons after a certain age in life. Age 9, age 12, or so, all right? Now, that was debunked something in about 15 years ago when it was found accidentally in terminally ill cancer patients. Then they were injected with a dye to look to see where cells were proliferating and growing. These individuals on hospice, injected with a dye, were discovered accidentally to be creating new neurons in their hippocampus, the primary memory center for fact-based and event-based memories. So neurogenesis, even if you are living a very frail life without much stimuli, you are on bed rest and you're terminal, still occurs in some select centers in the brain. So from that, we've also learned, how else can we promote neurogenesis? Can we do that with stem cell therapies? Can we do that with transcranial magnetic stimulation supplementations, or maybe, just maybe, living a novel, stimulated, socially connected life with high degrees of brief, intense exercise. Studies are still working on that. Really, the optimism is very high that neurogenesis can be impacted positively.
Great news on both counts. Thank you for that. You also write about the effect of lactate on the brain. I've never heard anybody else talk about that, the connection between exercise and lactate. What is lactate? Why is it good? How does it feed the brain, Mike?
Well, here you go. I'll show my age a little bit. In the 1980s, when I was starting physical therapy school, we thought at that time and for decades later that lactate was a negative byproduct from exercise. It's what caused us to feel delayed onset muscle soreness. And it was something to be prohibited and cleared, and we didn't want lactate. Now lactate has come around and become a darling child of the body because lactate is a byproduct of exercising hard. Exercising so hard that I can't bring in enough oxygen to be able to create the energy cycles and, let's just say, metabolize everything well. So lactate becomes a byproduct when I exercise too hard. That signals to the body, especially to the brain, hey, this person just exercised really hard. And this signaling molecule, lactate, helps to create a lot of cascades that, number one, signals release some growth hormone. This person has broken themselves down. They need to rebuild back up. Reinforce the blood-brain barrier and protect the network of, let's just say, arteries and veins that protect the brain from getting toxins and large chemicals and large molecules in there. And it also, lactate is a direct neurotrophic molecule, meaning it feeds the neurons of your brain. So it feeds the neurons, it protects the neurons, and it's a signaling molecule to help us improve performance.
Before we move on from the brain, and I know we won't entirely, but talk a little bit, if you will, Dr. Studer, about the brain-gut connection, because so much is being talked about and written about these days, about our microbiome, about really our second brain in our gut. What's going on in our gut that impacts our brain?
Okay, there's a lot to say there. I'll keep it succinct. Let me just give you fact number one, is that we think the gut-brain axis is this even interchange of information. And in reality, the gut's talking to the brain in 90% of the information particles that are going, and there's only 10% coming the other direction from the brain to the gut. So who's moving who here is point number one. Point number two, the microbiome, you bring it up, Mark. The microbiome is a collection of more let's just say microbiota, more cells, more organisms is the best term, then we have cells in our body. Let's say that one more time. These are not cells that are us. These are foreign bodies. These are organisms living inside of us, and they're more widely populated than there are cells in the human body. And these actually also influence our mood. They produce 90% of the serotonin that's produced in our bodies are produced by the microbiome. They tell us whether we're hungry or not, and they give us a sensation of cravings for certain things. How do we treat the microbiome well? Well, there's a diverse collection of microbiome. Our science on this is not perfect yet, but let's say a few succinct things. High sugary and high ultra-processed foods should actually deter the growth and proliferation of some of the microbiome. Some microbiome are going to like sugars, most are not. Almost all of them are going to like high fiber content, and they're going to produce something that is one of the most important elements I can say to you here is short-chain fatty acids, SCFAs. And that, those short-chain fatty acids, they reduce the amount of inflammation in our body. So then I'm going to bring us to the third and final segment on that question. Mark, you might have heard that Alzheimer's is the diabetes of the brain, okay? And that when people refer to that, they're talking about the inflammatory and breakdown processes that occur in microvasculature in the brain and in neuron-to-neuron connections. These short-chain fatty acids help to mitigate and reduce the inflammation throughout our body, but perhaps most importantly, in our brains.
We are speaking with Dr. Mike Studer. Who in the heck is this guy? Well, he's the author of this book, folks, The Brain That Chooses Itself. Mike, we've talked, we've done a pretty deep dive, if you will, into our brain. We've talked about physical activity. One of the other five pillars in your book, one of the five keys to increasing our own health span is nutrition. What should we be eating? What are we doing wrong, especially as we age, in terms of what we put into our body?
So the number one thing that we can say, and there are very few things that we can say for everyone, the number one thing is eating too many ultra-processed foods. Eating simple and eating diverse is much healthier. Now, beyond that, Mark, there's been a lot to debunk about nutrition, and I'm not going to be here with you and try to say that there's one single diet, the Mediterranean diet, that wins, or an approach to eating, intermittent fasting, time-restricted feeding, chronotropic nutrition, etc. It appears as though the things that we can say about nutrition are that keep it simple, keep it real, limit artificial sugars, try not to consume your calories by liquid, and also keep it diverse. There's a lot of suggestions that say get more fiber in, again, back to the microbiome, but also eat 30 different plants per week. So there's a lot to be said there: fiber, short-chain fatty acids, microbiome, reducing inflammation. But the final thing that I'll say about nutrition is this. It appears as though that calories in and calories out is too reductive. There appears to be some benefits in health in terms of how we are consuming 2,000 calories per day. So I'll very succinctly tell you that if I were to eat 2,000 calories per day in the form of 200 calories per hour times 10 hours, that's much less healthy than to eat three separate meals of about 666 calories, because you need to give your cells time to respirate. You need to actually cause your metabolism to go up and to go down, and you need to actually allow your blood sugar to be able to provide you with energy rather than to feed it constantly and just to be grazing throughout the day. So I'll turn that back to you. I hope that I've given you some powerful thoughts on nutrition.
Let's move on to sleep if we can, because that is also something that's on everybody's list as being critically important for all of us as we age. And you say that sleep is person specific. Can rest be as good as a sleep? Can a nap be rest? I mean, how do you define sleep, Mike, and why is it so important to us?
So the science on sleep it's still evolving and improving. Here are the things that we can say. The four main pillars appear to be QQRT. This is from the work of Dr. Matthew Walker: quality, quantity, regularity, and time. So if I want to actually get the best sleep, I need to probably go to sleep and wake up within about 30 to 45 minutes of the same time of night and morning every day. Here's why your comment is absolutely accurate, though, Mark. That same time is quite personalized. We have our own sleep chronotype. You could be a person that needs to go to sleep at 9:30, or a person that needs to or feels that they would prefer to go to sleep at 11:30. It's not prescriptive that everyone does the same, but each person should try to behave the same within about 30 minutes of their regular times, because melatonin, growth hormone, and the cycles of sleep that we naturally go through are depending on us to actually go through that at that same circadian rhythm every single night. So we benefit most through our cycles of sleep if we actually have that regularity in timing. You'll get better quality and quantity. Now I'm going to circle back to rest first, and then I'm going to go to naps. Rest is entirely different than sleep, and rest is the most person-specific attribute that we can talk about in this umbrella. So rest could be I'm in a hammock and I'm on a beach in 72 degrees. But some people would say, that's not restful. I'm thinking about all the things I'm not doing. I'm not being productive. So for some people, rest is actually volunteering and being productive. And so for some people, rest is being playful and participating and just being nonsensical and fun. So rest is healthy from a meditation, from a mindfulness, from a play, from music, from a dropping cortisol. It's all of those things because we need time to actually be kind of default mode brain and not activated brain. Now let's talk about naps. It appears as though everyone has a chronotype and a preference for a nap or not, and there is nothing to be shamed from having a nap as long as it doesn't interrupt your main bolus of sleep. And that's all you have to say about it. You could take your nap at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It could be like me, 8 minutes long, believe it or not. I'm very efficient. I'm down and I'm back up. And it actually releases this burden of fatigue, and you actually get a boost in cognitive performance without borrowing against your sleep time. And if you're a person that doesn't nap, just be sure not to shame the people that feel like they need to nap. Studies on this are 20 minutes, 30 minutes. If you start to go into a few hours, you're probably going to end up borrowing from your night's sleep, but that's person specific on that.
You know, Dr. Studer, I certainly don't party like I used to. I do work more than I ever have. And I find myself on occasion saying, you know what, I can make up for it afterwards. And in reading your book, I was fascinated with the idea that you really can't make up for sleep, but there is such a thing as sleep banking. Talk to us about sleep banking and why it actually works.
So sleep banking is fairly a new and novel concept for us. If we know we're going to have a long international flight, a stressful period, changing time zones even within a couple of hours, or we know that we're going to be staying up late, this is very novel and shocking that we can actually preload some sleep in the nights prior. Sleep banking helps us when we know we're going to have a debt. It has a much more challenging time actually paying it back than it does preloading. Sleep banking also helps us when we're going to go into a period that is particularly beneficial for learning. So if I know I'm going to have a big golf lesson or a big lecture that I need to be tested on later, or I'm going to go into a big meeting where I need to hold on to that information and turn it back around, I want to sleep bank before I'm delivered with some novel information of any kind, and that's helpful as well. So releasing some of that, what's known as adenosine load on ourselves by sleep banking, is a very healthy investment in ourselves.
You can bank sleep. So I got to ask you this, because I read something, and I like to say this, and I want to know that if I'm saying it, it's true. You can actually, to some extent, bank future fitness, because the nucleus in muscle cells are much different than others. And if you develop some sort of strength and stop working out, your muscles will atrophy to some extent, but the nucleus don't go away and they will refire at a later date. So if you're exercising today, even if you stop, if you take it back up at a later date, decades later, you will receive some benefit. Is that true, Dr. Studer?
That is 100% true. And I almost don't even need to elaborate on that. You've succinctly summarized it well. We are a compilation of what we've done in our lives, the memories we've put in, the endurance work that we've done, the strength work that we've done, the skills that we've learned, the balance that we've committed to ourselves. If you never invest in any of those things, you're left with an empty bank account. If you've invested in some of those things, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, it doesn't matter what age you did that, 60s or 70s. What you have invested will be more present than have never having invested at all. So no matter when you deposited or when you bought stocks of fitness, those will always be more readily available for withdrawal and resale than having never invested at all. So a lot of times individuals, as they age, are feeling like, well, I never really was an exerciser. Now's no time to start. Absolutely incorrect. You can invest in your 81-year-old self as a 72-year-old and do just fine in getting some return on investment.
It is never too late to invest in your health and get some great returns. But don't let that be an excuse to delay making key lifestyle changes, because the sooner you start, the better. When we return, the dangerous and dark side to the weight loss drug that millions are now taking. And you probably know that falling is the leading cause of injury and injury death for older adults, but you will be surprised by the second leading predictor of a fall. This is Growing Bolder.
Support for Growing Bolder provided by
Savings accounts should build wealth, not add expenses. Raisin gives savers access to high-yield savings accounts, money market deposit accounts, and certificates of deposit from over 70 banks and credit unions. Find, fund, and manage multiple savings products all through a single secure login. More information at raisin.com/growingbolder. Welcome back to Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton. We're speaking today with Dr. Mike Studer, one of the world's foremost brain health experts and the author of the new book, The Brain That Chooses Itself. Dr. Studer is also a geriatric rehabilitation expert and a falls prevention guru, so I asked him about taking GLP-1s to lose weight. More and more people are now taking them, but it turns out there's a dangerously dark side that very few people talk about. Up to 60% of the weight loss that we achieve is actually lean muscle mass and bone density, which results in many older adults with a large degree of frailty. I ask if that was something we all should be talking about more.
Yes, and you know, I won't be the one that often quotes Donald Rumsfeld, but it's the danger is the unknown unknowns, right? So what we don't know about longitudinal studies in GLP-1 agonists and that whole category, because we have not had people on it for 20s and 30 years, we don't know about the side effects in terms of some ocular changes and potentially even some cognitive changes that are being hinted at. But what we do know is that individuals that are consuming this need to make certain that what they are taking in for nutrition is high protein, and that they are doing the other. And there's only two things that will stimulate muscle growth: taking protein content and participating in resistance exercise. Make certain your high protein content and resistance exercise is something you're participating in on a regular basis.
All right, Dr. Mike Studer, let's move on to the fourth of your five key principles for maximizing our health span, and that is social connection, which is obviously something more and more people are talking about post-pandemic. Why is social connection so important to us? What does it do for us?
Well, number one, it averts the sense of loneliness. And Dr. Vivek Murthy, of all the contributions that he has made as a two-term U.S. Surgeon General, maybe hasn't made any more prolific of a contribution than to say that unintentional solitude, loneliness that you didn't choose, and remember, operative word choice here again, is equal to smoking about 15 cigarettes per day. So that is from a physical standpoint, mental health standpoint, cognitive standpoint, loneliness that we're not choosing is very unhealthy. So social connectedness that we choose counters that. So that's one thing. Social connectedness, even with a pet or another loved one, significant other, does many things that loneliness would be raising. And that is those social connections, pet and significant other, or just having a network of people that are in your tribe, lowers blood pressure and actually improves mood, dopamine, oxytocin opportunities, as well as serotonin. So we're improving mental health, reducing systolic blood pressure, and also that is really kind of a system-wide beneficial. Now, social connection does many other things that are somewhat still under the radar, unfortunately. you'll see study after study that says people that feel as though they have a support network will perform cognitively better in challenging circumstances. So I'm a home court player in a basketball game or football game. Well, in fact, that I would always want to bet on the home team, social connectedness, people supporting me. You're going in for a tough job interview, social connectedness, if I have people that are rallying me. And it doesn't matter if you feel that that power of prayer is something that you believe in, then that works as well. So social connectedness helps with cognitive performance, physical performance. It also helps us manage stressful life situations. Now, you'll see many studies that say if an individual goes through a stressful situation and they're lonely, that causes catastrophic mental health changes. If an individual goes through the same stressful situation and in fact they know they have a support structure, they can buffer it, they can move through. And I know you're going to get to this, Mark, but that actually ties nicely into the final segment, that novel experiences. If I have challenged myself toward novel experiences throughout my life, I'm more capable of tolerating stressful experiences now. And with a social support network, I can actually have those novel experiences myself or vicariously. I have a friend who survived cancer. She beat it. I feel more likely that I'll be able to beat it as well. That's a lot to say. And you're an expert on social connection. So I'll leave my answers with about five items length there.
No, that's great. So many fascinating concepts in your book. Most of us know, Dr. Studer, that falling is the leading cause of injury and injury death for older adults in the U.S. What I didn't know until I read your book is that a fear of falling is actually the number two predictor of a fall, second only to having recently experienced a fall. How does a fear of falling lead us to fall?
So fear, number one, is a cognitive distractor. It's an unhealthy psychological rumination that says, I had better be careful here. I might fall. What if I don't lift my right foot up enough? And, you know, this is very clear to all of your viewers and listeners that if your mind is preoccupied with the ruminating thoughts of fear, that distraction in and of itself will cause your performance to go down. And we all have that tendency for a self-fulfilling prophecy. You see, I might fall, I might fall, I might fall. You see there, I did fall. That also, fear is a leading predictor because it does something else. It creates a cycle known as fear-avoidant behavior, which causes people to be less physically active, which causes them to lose the very resources that they would need to have to prevent a fall. So I could go on about fear of falling, but let's just say two things. Number one, it's a distractor. Number two, it causes you to be less active, which causes you to be less capable, which increases your risk for falling.
We're going to have to do this again, Dr. Studer, because I've got more on my list. Before we wrap it up, though, I do have one more thing that I want to mention to you and get your take on, because compressed morbidity is something that I've become fascinated with. It's, I think, officially still a hypothesis, a theory, the idea that we can postpone the onset of chronic infirmity. And I think when was Dr. Fries back in 1960, I think primarily it was thought that we could postpone the onset of this chronic infirmity through medical advances. But what I believe has actually happened in reality is that active adults, masters, athletes, and not medical advances have actually proven the concept. Because, Mike, we see this all the time in very active older adults. They will square the curve, as they say, and they will go down in a day or two at the age of 95 or 105. And it just seems like that is a pathway, and compressed morbidity is truly something we can all achieve.
Yeah, that's right. So live long and die fast is actually the main goal for all of us, because that's truly the visual of squaring the curve, meaning that we want our health span to be as close to our lifespan as possible. And unfortunately, Mark, I think we're just now starting to get some momentum on this. But the United States is far behind. We lost 13% of the gap between health span and lifespan between the years 2000 and 2019, meaning that while our lifespan was increasing, our health span wasn't increasing as fast. And so the length of disability and the amount of disability in the United States went up. But let's go back to the first part of your comment that you introduced so eloquently here. And that is the fact that we thought the secret was going to be in healthcare, in medicine, in procedures, in supplements. And in fact, maybe the something to end on is the secret is stay out of healthcare. And I don't mean that healthcare is unhealthy for people. Just do everything you can to actually stay out of the position where you would need to be a consumer of healthcare, and you're going to do just fine.
That is a powerful, disturbing, and important statement. The secret to healthcare is doing everything possible to avoid being a consumer of healthcare. When we return, we'll wrap up our conversation with Dr. Mike Studer. This is Growing Bolder.
Support for Growing Bolder provided by
Rides with Uber help give older adults the freedom they need and deserve. Plus, many Medicare Advantage Flex cards help cover the cost of Uber rides to appointments and important deliveries with Uber Eats, like groceries and OTC medication. Learn more at uberhealth.com/card or call 1-866-827-4584.
My guard stood hard when abstract threats to noble to neglect.
Welcome back to Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton. As you've heard, Dr. Mike Studer has an informed opinion on just about everything that has to do with active longevity and healthy aging. At some point, a guy who is smart enough to ingest all of the research and all of this literature from so many different areas has to begin connecting the dots in a way that very few others can. So my final question was this: with all that he's studied, all that he's learned, is there one single most important key to happy, healthy, active, and joyful aging?
I think if there were one key that gives us a through line, it would be probably this: stay connected with people in surprising fashions that sometimes include cognitive innovation, sometimes includes physical stimulation, and sometimes includes healthy eating together. Imagine that. If I stay connected with people through any one of and a variety of those three, I'm going to be playful and cognitive stimulating. With this group of my friends, I'm going to be exertional. And with this group of my friends, we're going to celebrate eating healthily. Maybe that's going to be the key, because Mark, my plan is to see patients for the next still 30 more years, to stay engaged, to be purposeful and healthy. And, you know, if I make it to 120, I at least want to be to 119, you know, 0.8 of actually being functional independent. So I'm trying to apply everything. And that's my best summary for how to get there.
So many great insights on so many important topics from Dr. Mike Studer. His book is The Brain That Chooses Itself. It's filled with personalized strategies to extend your health span and your lifespan as well. You should check out his website. It's Mike Studer, that's STUDER.com, and follow him on Instagram. Well, folks, you know, we need actionable insight from thought leaders like Dr. Studer, because the facts don't lie. The statistics are not great when it comes to the overall health of Americans. In fact, the United States is number one in the world in healthcare expenditures per capita, but we're only 40th in the world in longevity, and we're 68th in the world in health span. Our healthcare system can and needs to do better, but its failures can't be our excuses. We're making some pretty big mistakes in the way that we live, the daily lifestyle choices that we make. Who is your primary care provider? You are. That's Growing Bolder. We'll see you next time.
The Growing Bolder radio show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC. All rights reserved.
This program was recorded at Growing Boulder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. Chief audio engineer is Mac Dula. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, blowing high and mighty traps. Countless fire and flaming road, using ideas as my maps. We'll meet on edges soon, said I. So much older then, I'm younger than that now. Half-right prejudice leap forth, rip down all hate I scream. Lies that life is black and white, spoke from my skull I dream. Romantic flanks of musketeers, foundation deep. Somehow, oh, but I was so much older.